Hello, it's News Talk's Jess Kelly here. Before we get to this podcast, I want to talk to the business owners out there who know the value of having the right partner behind them. When it comes to empowering your business, Electric Ireland is the trusted energy brand that Irish companies rely on. As Ireland's leading energy supplier, they offer fixed price plans, expert advice and future-focused solutions, including solar power installation to support your business on its journey to net zero. Electric Ireland, making your business brighter. Visit electricireland.ie/business to learn more. Now, enjoy your podcast.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
With Renault's award-winning hybrid and full electric lineup, where style meets tech, rethink Renault.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we'll talk about the reality of teens online. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram @JessKellyNT. Happy New Year. I hope you had a lovely Christmas break. And for those of you like me who were back in work over the last few days, I hope it has gone well for you. We are going to bring you the fourth part of Behind the Screens, which was recorded in Cork late last year. I was joined by Dr. Coleman Nochter, Claire Daly, who's a board member of CyberSafe Kids, and Aaron Wolfe, who's a representative of ASTI Principals and Deputy Principals Committee. We were there in partnership with CyberSafe Kids to talk about the realities of parenting in the digital age. And this episode very much focuses on the age cohort between 12 and 18. And I started by asking Dr. Coleman Nochter why it's important that we distinguish the separate groups within that age cohort.
Yeah, well, there's a huge developmental gap that happens in that time. Again, not only physically, their children are oftentimes much taller and puberty has struck and everything else. But there's an ability to perhaps think about things in a more complex way. And so when we're giving information to children, you talk about providing information in a spiraled fashion. So you start at very small children with very basics, and then you can, as they get older, give them more information, more complex information about that. So perhaps in the online world, a discussion that you might be able to have with a 17-year-old might involve, you know, a lot more curiosity of what they're looking at. Whereas the conversation with a 12 and 13-year-old is much more prescriptive around what to avoid, how to navigate it. By the time a child or teenager gets to 17 years of age, they're well established in terms of how and what they watch and what sort of content they engage with. But it's almost as important a conversation to have at 17, because oftentimes they don't expect you to be concerned about what they're going through. And one of the things I would say is any of those experiences that we just described, they're much more daunting when you're trying to manage them on your own. And whether that's having seen a video of something that's disturbing or, you know, and I talk about to a lot of teenage boys and they find maybe some of the content around masculinity, and they find themselves in these kind of chat rooms or in this space where there's lots of content that they're unsure about, but they can't find a way out of, that the algorithm has kind of put them there. And yeah, they're trying to not watch these videos, but they become compelled to watch them, or everywhere they turn there seems to be that messaging going on. And so for young people in that position, they need a curious parent. They don't need a judging parent. Does that make sense? So yeah, if you have a 17-year-old who's watching that content and starting to maybe espouse a value system that looks a bit like that, your approach is always about curiosity and empathy around what is it about that appeals to you. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it that you're interested in? What do you think it offers? And even some nudges to perhaps the content or the trueness of what they're hearing and what they're saying. What it definitely is that the longer a child is in that space, or teenagers in that space, the algorithm becomes very much polarized into one view. So as a parent, you almost have to become the counter narrative to that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So if I'm watching TikTok and I watch a girl playing an electric guitar and I spend more time watching that than I would somebody else, the algorithm will just keep sending me girls playing electric guitar. And before I know it, I don't even know that boys even play electric guitar, because all I'm seeing is the girls. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so the same thing can happen around Manosphere content or content around anything, around conservative values or the role of men in society, whatever it might be, you need somebody to say, there's also boys who play guitar. There's also, and allow them exposure to the counter narrative to what they're seeing. In terms of younger children, it's about, if you see this, you come to me. You know what I mean? Rather than, in retrospect, a 17-year-old, you're probably damage limitation, whereas in the 12 and 13-year-old, you're doing much more guidance and prescription. And it's like we said in the last session with those smaller children, a child that could come to you and say, this is what I've seen, is far safer online than a child who doesn't. You know, just because your child's not coming to you with these issues doesn't mean that they're not having their issues. Mm. It just means that maybe they don't feel comfortable enough saying that to you for fear of your response.
Yeah, and I think that is something that is sort of a parenting learning moment as well, of trying to not, you know, lose the head if and when your child comes to you saying, I've seen this on TikTok or wherever and it's upset me. Your first instinct might be to get the phone, throw it out the window and cut off the internet from the house, which again, from an emotional point of view, I would completely understand and empathise with. But from a practical point of view and a beneficial point of view, that's clearly not the way to go.
No, absolutely not. I mean, again, I go back to that. The curiosity is far more effective. Teenagers don't want advice. They tend to, they balk against advice. Because when you give advice, you're saying to them, you should, I know more than you, and you should know this already. And when, it's like no parent gives a child a phone excited, they give it with trepidation and they say, be careful. And I think this is the wrong decision. And teenagers hate an I told you so parent or a face that says, now, didn't I tell you that was going to happen? That's not going to make them come to you with any sort of a disclosure about what they're experiencing. But saying to them, gosh, tell me more about that. How did that happen? What was happening about it? And you don't have to have the solutions, but you need to be able to sit in the mud with them a little bit and help them find their way out. Not through advice, but through support.
Yeah. I think curiosity is key, and I think that is a good message to take away. Another point that I would like to make, and this is just something that's benefited me as an adult, is that it is possible to reset your algorithm on social platforms. So whether your teenagers are on TikTok or Instagram, you can go into the settings, go to content preferences, and you can reset the algorithm. And I think that's something that's really worth doing on a regular basis, because it just stops that echo chamber. And if it's something that you're genuinely interested in, it'll redevelop over time and it'll learn your interests again. But it just stops the noise and stops the suffocation. And I think, as I said, I do it as an adult and I find it really beneficial. It's worth having that chat with your children and seeing if they'd firstly be up for it, but also if they can show you how to do it, and then if they'd be willing to do it themselves as well. I think it is a good thing to do.
Can I just say something? Some teenagers seem very savvy around technology, about how to navigate things, but stuff around that sort of savviness, many of them wouldn't know that. Mm-hmm. And I know from talking to teenagers about resetting an algorithm, when we tell them about that, it's news to them. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, you know, just because your kid is well able to finish an online game or do something quite techie or reset the Wi-Fi code or whatever it is, doesn't necessarily mean that their knowledge around the literacy of media is very good.
And that's something that, again, that sort of responsibility sits with the tech platforms to make that more accessible. That is something that's changed in recent years. They have made it easier to find content preferences, to control what information advertisers have about you or assumptions they make about you. But you're in control of that and your child can be in control of that. So it's even worth flagging with them that if they go into their settings, go to content preferences, just reset it. And as I said, genuine interest will spring up time and again. That's how these things are built. But it is a good way to press pause and reset. Aaron, I want to bring you in from a school point of view. I left school in 2007. So I was in Clochdiscegan in Dublin from 2001 to 2007. And on the first page of the Deal and Scullagh was our school policy. And you had to wear your uniform, you had to have your coat, you had to have your name on your coat. Phones weren't allowed on campus. Now this was, I left the year of the iPhone. So this was my Nokia, Blockia thing that was huge and hefty and whatever. But there was a phone policy in my school. In 2025, there are phone policies in school.
Yes.
And yet the issues have obviously exacerbated since I left school. How frequently are parents or students knocking on the principal's door saying, there's an issue in relation to a phone, a social platform or something like that.
Well, it does happen now. I suppose it was kind of a bit blown out of proportion, though, by the government introducing the phone away boxes. Was the kind of a thing that was introduced.
And only 9 million euro.
Oh, 9 million euro for a problem that didn't exist in schools.
Yes.
Like, we tackled our phone policies back in 2005 when phones started. Like, a lot of the problems don't actually happen on the school grounds. The problems are when they go home. So most schools had banned the use of phones. Phones might go off occasionally, but we're not overridden with phones going off every second. The problems happen, sadly, when the student leaves the school. So we do have phone policies, but there's only so much a school can do. And it just goes back to, you know, the parent is the primary educator, and the parent has a responsibility at home to be making sure their child is safe online, because we can't control what the children do when they leave school. And that's the sad part when it comes to online bullying. The bullying now follows the child home. So back along when we were all in school, if you were being bullied, it would at least finish at 3:30 or whenever you got off the bus. Sadly, now bullying follows the child home, and it can feel like there's no escape.
So what's being done? Like, you said that the parent is the primary educator, but kids spend an awful lot of their waking hours in school. Do we need a digital education curriculum? Or
well, they always say, you know, when society has a problem, education gets an itch. And there's only so much our education system can do.
Mm.
And I suppose a lot of complaints from the ASDI would be that we have initiative overload in schools, and you are given, you know, there's a problem with toxic masculinity, let's give it to the schools to solve. There's a problem with consent, let's give it to the schools to solve. So schools are being overburdened by a lot of trying to squeeze all this into an already very tight curriculum. Yes, we're offering a holistic education, but we have to prepare you for the Leaving Cert as well. And that's where the schools run into difficulty. You know, we're not trained experts in online safety. We're not trained experts in teaching students about consent. We went to university to become English teachers and maths teachers. And now we have this additional, like, that there's a teacher crisis in this country at the moment, a teacher shortage. And it's because the role of teaching has become so complex. We're no longer just teachers. We're social workers. We're counsellors. We're working much more with families. It's putting off a lot of people that don't want to be in the classroom anymore.
Mm. And so, Claire, that's one of the issues that, for as long as I can remember and as long as I've been doing this job, has existed. The responsibility for digital education has fallen between a few stools, between the parents hoping the school will do it, the school saying that it's on the parents to do it, the government assuming the phone pouches is the answer. There's too many gaps and too many assumptions being made there. So what is the answer?
I think it rests, I suppose, in the pillar of the parent and hopefully the school as well, that there would be a bit of a conjoined approach. Certainly the parent, and that's why Save Your Civic Kids is offering an awful lot of resources around, you know, we do lunchtime check-ins now in relation to, I suppose, short information briefings around online safety and tips and tricks for keeping your children safe online. But certainly it does land with the parents. I suppose the difficulty with that, a lot of parents would say that they're not tech experts, you know.
And that's the thing, is nobody's taught us how to, like, I figured out how to work a computer because I was the nerdy kid in school and I could type. And so Inni Hirdon made me digitize every book in the library. That meant writing in the title, the author, hitting save, putting the IBAN in, and then I could explain it. And at the time, that was something to shut me up, but it's turned out to be essentially my job. So I kind of learned by doing, and I explained to other people what I did. But I don't have any education or qualification in terms of how to use Microsoft Teams or whatever it is, and yet we're doing it. So there is a massive education gap, and I'm not saying it falls on the schools, but across the board, from the newest born baby to the oldest person on the planet, there is a knowledge gap there and an education gap.
There is, and I suppose that's what we'd always say, you know, if your child is downloading Snapchat or whatever the case may be, that you would also then Google it yourself, figure out where the controls are, figure out how to set up the app. You know, it's always safer if the parent sets up the app with the child rather than the child sets up the app themselves, because invariably if the child sets it up themselves, they're putting in the age themselves and the date of birth, etc. Whereas if the parent sets it up with the child, they can try and bring in those parameters, those parental controls that exist as much as possible. But also to learn with the child just what the child is doing online would be very important. And I suppose so that education piece, you're not just educating the child, you're educating yourself around the app or the new technology, because there's always going to be a new thing. You know, now we're talking more about AI, so things are changing all the time. There's always going to be a new step, a new thing to learn. So I suppose it's learning with the child as much as possible and being curious and being involved in their life and what they're doing online, rather than giving them the device and saying, off you go now, good luck. Yeah, it's doing with them as much as possible.
Just something in schools that's coming up is, you know, the use of Snapchat. And when a parent does come in and they say, look, my child, these comments were said to my child online, and you ask to see the messages, but the messages delete themselves.
Yeah.
So it's hard for schools then to get the evidence. So what we would advise parents to do is that if your child comes to you to use your phone and take a photograph of the Snapchat images that have been sent, but then that works against students as well, because students that are sending messages that they think are going to be deleted, every student in the country probably has two phones, and they're sharing photos. You know, well, I sent it to him. I sent a picture of myself to my boyfriend and no one else can see it, but he takes it on his other phone and the copy gets out there. There's all those dangers, but it can be used to protect students if the parent takes a picture and brings it to the school. But just a word of warning that the new government framework, BConulta, that's running this, the anti-bullying policy, it does state in that schools do not have to investigate bullying cases that happen outside of school. Now, most reasonable principals would, but to an extent, we can't check phones. We need hardcore evidence of saying, well, there's the screenshots, these messages were sent, but they do delete. So parents, make sure you take the photograph yourself of the message that was sent on Snapchat.
Yeah, you are listening to Behind the Screens here on News Talk. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation.
Tech Talk on News Talk.
With Renault, leaders in tech, built to entertain and keep you safe. Rethink Renault.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. I'm bringing you Behind the Screens, Part 4, focusing on teenagers. And I'm going to bring you back into the conversation with Coleman Nochter, Claire Daly and Aaron Wolfe. And I asked Coleman, when did things change, whereby commentary that teens and kids make to each other went from a simple, I don't like you, to something more aggressive and sinister?
Yeah, and any sort of online text-based communication is going to have a degree of severity that doesn't exist in a face-to-face, because in that communication you're disembodied. So I'm talking to you and I'm slagging your glasses and you get upset, I see your reaction. I'll tone down. Do you know what I mean? I'll say, but if I'm talking to a screen or on a headset and there's some vile things said over the online gaming, like, my son has shown me messages about he missed a talk and they're, you know, go kill yourself or you're autistic or all these horrendous things being said. And those exchanges wouldn't happen in a face-to-face context. They happen because of the distance afforded by online, right? Mm. What I'm saying is we need to have young people gathering in spaces more. Like I was saying to you earlier on, we're seeing the first group of young people that didn't grow up on the street or the road or the green.
Yeah.
And without that sort of, those are the places where we learn those social emotional skills, conflict resolution, how to become autonomous decision makers, how to have that space. The social atrophy caused by that and by children growing up in a screen-based, a phone-based childhood rather than a play-based childhood are not going to have the ability to read those cues. I work in a third level university and I teach, you know, communication skills is one of the things I teach. And the ability to listen and tell a story are two skills that are fundamental to your ability to function in the world. And I see those year on year becoming less and less able. They're two skills that are almost like a dying art, if that makes any sense. And the idea that we value those sort of soft skills, if you want to talk to them, those, we need children offline, in person, having those face-to-face conversations to develop those skills. Because in the other world, the cruel exchanges, the disembodiment, and we look at technology, take dating apps, right? The idea of swiping someone out of your life is such an aggressive thing. That creeps into the narrative of, you know, of how we feel about people.
Yeah,
they become disposable.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so when you're growing up in a world where that's the way in which people are treated, the more important thing is children have arrived to this in the middle of the story. They don't have they don't have the chapters that went before. Mm-hmm. So we all assume that we have those because we have that pre-internet experience. We're now seeing children who have no pre-internet experience. This is how they function, right? So things you were saying about when you were learning about being told to say please and thank you, you know, there's evidence to suggest that children who have an Alexa in their house have poor manners because they don't say, please, can you get this, or thank you for that. You know, you're not supposed to ask ChatGPT, say please, because you use up more water or something. You know, so from the point of view, we're teaching the execution of no courtesy and manners. Does that make
sense?
It's
directness, then. I want this, do it.
Exactly. And almost then, the more humanized the technology becomes, the more dehumanized we become.
Yeah, and that is something that I think we're going to delve a little bit deeper into in a second. I said delve, which is a ChatGPT word. I'm not a robot, I promise. But we're going to talk about AI in a minute. But Claire, I want to go back to gaming for a second, because I know this is an area that you've looked at, and there are some concerning stats and insights around what tends to be predominantly boys and young men in the gaming sphere.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we did, in the trends and usage report, we did see that gaming was extremely popular still with that cohort. Probably more popular with the 8 to 12 year olds in the survey, but definitely 12 to 15, you're still seeing teenagers spending an awful lot of their time online gaming. And I suppose the difficulty is, as they get to the older age group, the difficulty in trying to keep eyes and ears on what's going on in the game, because they're wearing headphones. A lot of teenagers in particular want to be gaming, I suppose, in their bedrooms, in their kind of private spaces, and that makes it harder again for parents to keep an eye on what's happening and kind of regulate the gaming as much as can be done. I mean, there is a big difference, as you said, between a 12-year-old and a 17-year-old. Mm-hmm. So you'd expect the 12, 13-year-old, you're still having eyes on the interactions on the online gaming and what messages they're receiving and what messages they're giving out as well. So I think in the survey that we found that in terms of encountering sexual content or content that disturbed, 21% of those 12 to 15-year-olds, they reported encountering nudity or sexual contact or contact in games and apps. So still very much prevalent in that age group, that content that they weren't seeking out and weren't looking for coming to them also in gaming as well as social media.
Did you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, just on the gaming issue. Mm. The if we were playing a game back in the 90s, early 2000s, Mega Drive, Sega Mega Drive, you and I'd be playing side by side.
Yeah.
And we'd have the thing and we'd be shouldering each other and playing. If teenagers want to play their game now, they must go to their own houses in order to play. My son had some friends over and they're all standing around one person playing at a time. And that's not by accident. The tech companies have designed it so that we are as virtually dependent as possible and as physically disconnected as possible, because when we're physically connected, we're not spending time together. So the tech company could create a social app in the morning where I'm walking down the street and it says, Jess is in Costa, you know, go down and have a cup of tea with her and we could meet up. They won't do that, because when we meet, we'll put our phones down and we'll have a conversation. And the way in which the digital space is designed is to keep us as virtually connected as possible and as physically disconnected. Mm-hmm. And so teenage boys who want to play together, it's a very isolative experience. If you looked at an image of two people gaming in the late 90s, early 2000s, they would be two people together. Look at it now, it's a dark room, it's a headset, and it's gaming on their own. And again, that's that idea of the isolation causes the communication fault, causes the emotional and behavioral issues, because you're not having a counter narrative of a face-to-face contact, or certainly not enough of it.
Yeah, I have really been struck, and there was a lot of conversation in the wake of Adolescence. Did everyone watch Adolescence? Yeah, like I was blown away by the press coverage in the wake of Adolescence, because some outlets made it sound like this is the first time that issues of kids in WhatsApp groups or, you know, messaging apps has been problematic. Obviously, that was a drama. It was fiction. It was worst case scenario. But there is a problem, and you alluded to it earlier, Coleman, in relation to the manosphere and how young boys are not only presenting themselves online, but the content they're consuming online. Aaron, have you seen a shift in how young boys are presenting themselves and interacting with each other and others?
Oh, absolutely. There is a rise in toxic masculinity. Another problem, I think the phrase we've used in schools anyway is an emotional contagion. What you said there about if you watch loads of videos of someone playing a guitar, you're going to see all these videos of someone playing guitar. What we found is that they spend a lot of time watching influencers talking about well-being, but they're not talking about feeling good. They're talking about how their darker times and talking about depression. And then that kind of spreads. And there's not enough out there of influence talking that it's okay. Okay, it's okay to be down, but it's also okay to feel good about yourself, and it's okay to feel happy. And there's not enough out there like that. And so we find that in schools, they're all watching these influencers talking about depression. That seems to spread in the school. And just like that, watching, this is how a man should act. That is spreading. But also for the girls, with pornography, girls are being taught, you know, this is how a girl should look. This is how a girl should act. Mm. This is what sex is. And they get this total, you know, pornographic version of what sex, totally false relationships. This is how it, you know, schools dealing with cases of, you know, young people thinking that choking is okay and things like that. So it is crazy. I just wanted to go back just about the phone away boxes, because I think the way to solve this isn't actually taking the phones off them. It's teaching them responsibility, how to talk online to each other. But it's not just children that are guilty of speaking poorly online. You just go onto Facebook and you see, or you go into the parent WhatsApp groups, yeah, and you see parents, how parents all talk about the school. Most schools have a way into seeing those WhatsApp groups. I always get sent screenshots anyway.
I love the tea that we're getting here about the school. This is great gossip.
Well, it is, you know, but everyone here, we're all parents, and we've seen how parents do talk about the school, and children get to see that, or they go online and they see the comments under. So a radio station puts up, we won't say it's News Talk, but someone giving out about schools looking for, we'll put the dreaded subject of the voluntary contribution. Schools looking for the voluntary contribution. And all of a sudden, all the parents are going ballistic about the voluntary contribution and going to town on the schools. Now, it's not the school's fault, again, mm-hmm, underfunded. But parents speak very poorly. You know, adults ourselves, we act poorly online. So children see that and maybe they think they can speak poorly online. So how do we get to it? Teaching children, be conulta, be kind to each other.
Yeah.
Responsible phone use. So phones in schools also have a lot of good value rather than frightening parents. Like TikTok's one of the best things a school can have. The school TikTok account builds a brilliant ethos, a brilliant culture every single day. And the principal of the school, a real miserable man, and children come up to me every day, teenagers, please, Mr. Wolf, will you be in a TikTok with us? And they absolutely love it. It's a great way to engage with young people, chatting about TikTok, them wanting to be influencers. So there's an awful lot of good comes out of social media if we teach our children how to use it responsibly. Schools can do it, but parents have a huge part to play in it.
Yeah, and I think you're dead right. Like, social media is great, and YouTube is great in terms of an educational tool as well. Like, I think there's a real benefit there, and there's a place for it. But not only do we need to teach them how to use it, we also need to teach them how to identify bullshit, because there's an awful lot of it online from the influencers who are telling you that they were feeling really, really down, but they started drinking this tea and you can get it for 25% off. Use my code, click this link.
Well, thanks very much. I run my school's TikTok account. So as a result, my TikTok thing has the algorithm of a teenage girl. So only today I was going through it with a student, and the amount of rubbish we had to watch. And one, I won't mention the influence, but it was a guy, a young fella who has thousands of followers, talking about what words men can use. Is it okay to use this word? And I was saying to them, do you really watch this? Oh, we do, yeah. And so they're following this fella just saying, can you use this word if you're a guy? Yeah, we're going to vote, can we? Which, that's nonsense. Use whatever words you want.
But Coleman, that, like, this melts my brain a bit, because to me, this comes back to role modelling and engaging in conversations and saying, okay, so you like watching the man that Aaron just mentioned there. Why is it? Like, what is it about it that you find interesting? And having, not necessarily a debate, but having a conversation with your child. Are we, as the adults in the room, doing that enough? Are we engaged in person in their digital lives in the right way rather than in the helicopter parent way?
Yeah, and I'm not even sure it's the helicopter parent. I think we dismiss their engagement as rubbish, or, you know, all that sort of stuff. Like, and, you know, the latest, like, brain rot stuff around, I don't know if you're familiar with 6-7 and all that sort of stuff.
I'm not. I don't want to know. I'm sick of hearing it.
But the idea of actually making codified language that adults don't understand is part of a kind of cognitive development process. You know, it's no different to aggy, 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 I. It's been happening, you know. So from the point of view of, they're just doing it in a way that we don't understand and don't appreciate. Mm. But rather than dismissing that as rubbish, curiosity will get you far. You know, why do you watch that? What, and say, like, the Manosphere stuff doesn't start out with kind of toxic masculinity stuff. It says, you know, do you want to train harder? Do you want to have focus? Do you want to do this sort of stuff? And so it's quite enticing at the beginning around, oh, maybe I would like
motivational to be, yeah.
And maybe I would like a bit of focus, and maybe I do need that in my life. And very soon then you're tipped into these kind of really dangerous messaging around, you know, where women belong in the home and all this sort of rubbish. But from the point of view of, by the time you're getting to that, you're knee deep in it. And rather than following one of these guys, there's 40 of them. Yeah. You know? And the algorithm knows, in Silicon Valley, they have a principle that says enraging is engaging, right? So anything that makes you annoyed, angry, or upset, you're going to see much more of it. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And so we have, you know, and you have examples yourself of setting up sock puppet accounts, fake accounts, and finding, like, as a 14-year-old, and finding all this content coming at you, and it's the depressive stuff and the suicidal stuff. And but the idea that if I said I'm having a really bad day, that might get 10 views, whereas I said I'm feeling like ending it all, and that gets 400 views, I'm going to send more and more of those video, you know, those types of videos, because, and that's how the human mind works. If you and I are sitting there and we're looking at a flower shop, and a couple start having a row behind us, we're looking to the row, we're not looking to the flowers. And so the ability of the algorithm to hack our emotional and psychological world in order for us to go into these sinkholes and down these kind of rabbit holes of stuff is, there's billions of dollars being spent on psychology experts trying to develop these kind of persuasive technologies. Do you know what I mean? And so from the point of view of a kid, a 16-year-old or 15-year-old hasn't a chance against that stuff. But if you're a parent who's curious and is able to offer that counter narrative and is, you know, having some sort of a balanced view of what it is that they're seeing, I said to you before, I'd much prefer my child to learn how to drive while I'm in the passenger seat than when I'm on a weekend away. Mm. And so the idea is you're far better positioned to be beside them. But if you're dismissing everything that they watch as rubbish and, you know, that's 6-7 nonsense, they'll never invite you in. Does that make sense? And curiosity and empathy are the two things that adolescents, that it's the way to an adolescent's mind or brain. Dismissiveness or talking down to them or patronizing, you're not going to get it. Does that make sense?
I was just going to say there, like, as a parent, I suppose, to go on TikTok maybe with your child, to go through their new, their feed with them in a friendly way, because you'll see what they're getting to watch. There's like, the influencers have huge influence in so much as telling boys, this is how you should dress now. I think you've all probably heard of Yup Bros, that now boys, it's the fashionable thing to have a hairbrush, you must have the handle snapped off, you must constantly be brushing your fringe, you must wear a Monterrain tracksuit, and that's how that's how you act, and you have certain phrases that you use, and they're the Yup Bros, and you must stand in a certain way, your finger is up, or your thumb is is crooked. And as parents, you might have a parent, you might be a parent of a Yacht Bro, and he's probably very cool. But that's the influence of influencers. They are, they really are inside. And then, I mean, there's one influencer, we were talking about being upset, who checked her Leaving Cert results online, and it went absolutely mental because she didn't get the results she wanted. But a lot of people are saying, you know, she probably did get the results she wanted, but she knew crying would get her more views. And so, you know, that's what we're living in. And then that rolls back into schools, that they see, this is what we think as educators, they see the drama gets the views. So when they come into school, this will get the attention. And we were just talking, you just mentioned there about how the TikTok companies and all that spend so much on psychologists. Again, I'm going back to the department. They're not spending the same money on the schools.
Yeah.
We need more counsellors in schools. We need psychotherapists in schools because the problems have increased. We noticed actually the huge change after COVID, that students came back from COVID far unfriendlier than they were. And we as educators put it down to the fact that they got so into living online that you could quickly dismiss someone. I don't like you anymore, so I'm not talking to you. And when they came back into the real world, they carried on like that. I can ghost someone. But you can't do that. That's not nice.
No, but you know what's funny? And again, it's not funny, but as an adult, so I had pneumonia last year. I was sick for about 10 days and I was home alone for 10 days. I couldn't really talk, so I was in agony and I was miserable. And I went back to the office, and when people came up to me, I was like, oh, please go away. Like, I just had no tolerance for it. And so you can see, again, when a child is at that stage and age where they're developing, if that's what they've known during the pandemic, it kind of makes sense.
Can I make a comment on that? I know. This gets my goat, right? They used to have a thing called, like, we're talking about the return of the village and community, and we need to get the tribe back in real world. And I genuinely think that is a traditional solution to a contemporary problem. But they used to have a thing called fear of missing out, FOMO. Now we have JOMO, which is the joy of missing out.
Yeah.
And if you're parents and you're celebrating when somebody cancels plans, or you're, and hands up, the psychology movement have a lot to answer for here. We were the ones going, put boundaries down, say no, be selfish, all that sort of stuff. That's avoidance. That is not self-care. Do you know what I mean? From the point of view, and young people and teenagers are seeing this. They're seeing us celebrating isolation. Like when I was growing up, people came to my house all the time. Mm. My parents, and I met older people, and they were people I didn't know, and they were interesting people's characters. But from the point of view of, I've lived in my house for 2 years, I could count on one hand the amount of visitors I've had to my home, right?
Yeah.
And if anyone's coming, they must give me a week's notice so I can go upstairs and scrub the skirting board in the back toilet in case somebody goes in and has a look in there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we have formalized community, you know, and you talk about, you know, the idea of that, being able to call into somebody and somebody saying, I'd be horrified if you came to my house unannounced. And like those, so that's the rules of engagement have changed.
Yeah.
And the social rules of engagement have changed. And I was saying to you earlier, and the teenage boys are really ones I struggle with. Teenage boys around 15, 16, they were kids that before pandemic, they were the play date kids. So these kids were, your parents looked after their social world. You can go to Tommy's, Tommy's can come to us. Then pandemic hit and they came out and they were kids who were in second year or third year. They had no social architecture to how to do that, to how to say, do you want to come to my house so we meet and go to the cinema? And I see so many of these boys, 14, 15, 16, who have a real appetite for social interaction, but no ability. They don't see anyone outside of school.
Yeah.
And it's a real, there's a real loneliness to that. And I genuinely believe that, like, I'd look at the 9 to 12 year olds and I look at the teenagers and say, well, what's coming down the line for them? Mm. And I see the teenagers now and I look at what's coming down the line for them, looking at the 18 to 25 year olds. Anxiety was the biggest problem we were dealing with for the last 5-10 years. Loneliness is the biggest one now. And I work in a third level campus. 5 o'clock in our campus, it's dead. Everyone's gone home. Right? The idea of having those connections and those relationships are not happening. College life is a completely different experience to what we would have had before. Young people coming through are going down the same road.
Yeah.
And we need to address that by offering and selling and pitching. The return of youth clubs is my, I want the return of youth clubs, but the ones that are cool and ones that people want to go to. I think there's never been more of a need for something like that. And that, and that's not a responsibility for schools. I think that's the community responsibility.
Thing, yeah.
But I think the idea that we would have these opportunities for young people to gather, because I think we're, technology will always give them what they want. It'll never give them what they need.
Yeah, Dr. Coleman knocked her there. We're going to pick up this conversation right after this.
Tech Talk on News Talk.
With Renault. Leaders in tech. Built to entertain and keep you safe. Rethink Renault.
Yeah, you're very welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk, bringing you my conversation with Dr. Coleman Nocter, Claire Daly and Aaron Wolfe, a representative of the ASTI Principals and Deputy Principals Committee. Before the break, we were talking about the loneliness our young people experience. We now obviously have AI too, and we're seeing young people lean towards these platforms for companionship and advice. I asked Claire Daly of the CyberSafe Kids Board if this is an area of concern.
Yes, hugely concerning. I think just listening to Coleman talk about this loneliness epidemic in teenagers, it's clear to see why it's so easy for a teenager to, you know, engage with these chatbots in particular in terms of companionship. There was a study released last week in the UK and it said there was a survey of high school students and it said 1 in 5 of those high school students said that they'd had a romantic relationship with a chatbot. And you're thinking at such an age when they should be exploring relationships and friendships, the fact that they're learning from those partially from robots is quite terrifying. And a lot of these, you know, the chatbots in particular, they're not regulated. There's no legislation around them. And a lot of these technologies are experimental technologies. Mm. So are we experimenting on already a generation of young people that are growing up in a very, you know, warped world where there's a huge loneliness issue stemming from COVID, stemming from a very unnatural situation they survived over a number of years, but we were locked down. And now what are we having these youngsters learning about relationships from robots.
Mm. And it's worth noting as well for parents in the room, you know, there's AI built into WhatsApp now. So if your kids are using WhatsApp, there's the My AI on Snapchat. Like, it's ingrained everywhere. And you can see, as someone who uses it, you know, I could ask it the stupidest thing. So I can't drive and I can't cook. They're my two biggest failings as a human. So sometimes if my partner's away, I'll go to ChatGPT and I'll be like, can you explain how to make a cheese toasty? And it'll do it. But the first thing it'll say is, that's a great question, Jess. Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. Well done, you at 36 years of age, not being able to butter bread. But it starts with that positive, and it'll always give you that positive, well done you for asking that question. And come back to me again and I'll tell you a bit more about it. Is there anything else I can do for you? It is intoxicating for young people who perhaps aren't fitting in their friend group or aren't getting the attention that they feel they deserve, you know, from other outlets. So what can parents practically do to intervene there?
It is very difficult, and not to, I suppose, labour the point or be alarmist about it. There has been legal cases in particular in the US where young people have become so attached to their companionship AI that they have resulted in some young people taking their lives, where they have been, in one case, prompted to do so by the AI, were fed information to the person. In another case, the person became completely enmeshed emotionally in that, you know, the companionship AI. So the notion, I suppose, that they're becoming somewhat bedazzled by this illustration of a companionship, when in fact it's just software repeating back and echoing back to the teen. It's very alarming, and I suppose it would go back to that piece around, in terms of parents, that engagement, that communication, that, I suppose, trying to draw the teen out and trying to be curious about what it is that they're getting from the chatbot, because, as I say, they're not regulated, so it's easy for a child to sign up and to avail of it and to have an account. So I suppose it is just that curiosity and being aware, and trying to keep other balances in the home in terms of other relationships in the home and around it as much as possible.
Coleman?
Yeah, no, I'm seeing it in the therapy room all the time, that now, you know, it used to be when you went to a GP, you're saying, you know, don't mistake your Google search for my medical degree. But in the same way, they're saying, well, ChatGPT told me that I should do this. ChatGPT doesn't know you in terms of your own circumstances. And so what it's suggesting, and ChatGPT is essentially quite narcissistic. So if you say to ChatGPT, I'm having a row with my boyfriend because he won't make me a cheese toasty, it's going to go, you go and dump him, sister, because, you know, and it'll always give you back what you want as opposed to what you need. But there's a bigger question. I know we talk about machines and what if they turn on us and all that sort of stuff. For me, it's a bigger question around truth and what it is we can trust, right? I'm getting emails from colleagues using words that they've never used in their life. I will forego your offer for a coffee.
You're going, delve. That, yeah, you know, delve.
ChatGPT has written that, right? Yeah. And if you are in a, let's say, sorry to use your relationship again, but if you have a row with your boyfriend and he comes back and says, Jess, I'm really sorry for what I said. I realize I was really unfair to you in that instance, and I swear it will never happen again. I will make it up to you, I promise. And you're going, this is brilliant. But you find out ChatGPT wrote that.
Yeah.
Then that completely undervalues what he's said to you, because 100%. It hasn't come. So if we relate from a ChatGPT to ChatGPT perspective, what happens to the trust in human connection? How can I trust that your offer of help is genuine? How can I trust that what you're saying is what you feel? And that has huge implications for us as a society and for young people who are growing up in a world where everything is being asked to ChatGPT. Is this text okay? Change it for me. You know,
it can get stuff wrong. I just want to scream this from the rooftops. ChatGPT, all these platforms are like the most annoying, swaggery so-and-so you've ever met in your life who doesn't know how to say, I don't know. Mm. It's like never admit it's done something wrong. You can prompt it to say accuracy is key, using facts, blah, 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 blah. But the onus is on you, the human, to firstly know to do that and to watch out for the fact that it doesn't know, because it's never going to say, you know what, figure it out yourself.
Yeah,
it's just not.
I know somebody refers to it as ChatGTP because he's just your annoying, but your overconfident colleague who actually has a great opinion, but it's not necessarily right, talking about, like, parents and adults, we're as guilty as using AI as well. Every letter that comes in now to schools complaining is written by ChatGTP telling us they're in breach of the Education Act. And it's always wrong, you know. And then just to go back to your point there about that... you know, it says, great point, well done you. We're raising a group of young people, you know, who are lacking that resilience, and everything they do is, well done you, and now you can't fail in schools. You know, we're guilty of this, that we're, you know, when you do your junior cycle, you don't fail your junior cycle, you partially achieved it. But that's not raising children that are going to be able to face the reality in life of, you didn't get that job, you know, you're unsuccessful here. We, you know, when we're picking soccer teams, it's now, you know, everyone should have a go. Well, maybe it should just be the good soccer players. You know, we want to win the match. Primary schools running, you know, it's a non-competitive sports day. But life isn't like that, you know. And are we raising a generation of young people, you know, who will be very soft? And, you know, they say, you know, hard people create soft time, soft people create hard times. And is that what we're moving towards? Because we will have, we do have a lot of young people now who don't have the ability to be told no, or to be told you failed, you weren't picked for the school show. And then you have parents who come in and say, well, my daughter should have been picked for the school show. Well, you weren't there in the audition. You know? There could be someone better than your child, but no one's better than my child. And that's where we're in a problem, in education, certainly, anyway.
Yeah, I want to bring in some of the questions here, because there are some good ones here in the mix. So the first one that caught my eye there is, can you reset the algorithm for TikTok? Child being fed a lot of skinny girl images. Yes, and that is a massive problem. So you can go into your... So if you go to the profile, go to settings... go to content preferences, and then you can reset the algorithm there. As I said earlier, I would recommend doing that frequently. Another question here, Coleman, I might throw to you. My teenager has her phone in the bedroom. How do I try to stop that now?
With great difficulty, I think. It's always difficult to row back on measurement rather than extend it. So you'd always suggest that when getting a phone first, you start narrow and widen as you go, rather than trying to do the other way around. I think you mentioned about the CyberSafe Kids research around having phones in bedrooms at night and having phones outside of surveillance. I think there's absolutely no age limit to somebody not having their phone in their bedroom at night. And what we really underestimate from a mental health perspective is the value of sleep. Sleep is, it's no different to recharging your phone. Excuse the bad example there, but we need it desperately. We are the most sleep deprived generation that ever lived. Netflix said that their biggest competitor is sleep, in terms of, you know, we're staying up later, we're watching all this sort of stuff. Sleep is the cornerstone of your energy levels, your biology, and your ability to function. And if we're neglecting that side of ourselves, we will struggle. And I'm guessing you're seeing tired students.
Well, there was a great study that was done through UCC involving my school and other schools called Benefit, where students were given a sports watch. And we were telling them, it was about measuring their steps. What we were actually tracking was how much sleep they were getting at night. And we were able to see so many students were up in the middle of the night, and they were on Snapchat, TikTok, again, running my own school's TikTok account on our Instagram. We can see that some students are up at 4 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, liking videos. You think they're asleep, they're not, and then they're coming into school, they're exhausted. And how can they function in school? They're irritable then, that creates more drama, you know, and it's sleep is absolute huge problem in schools.
So to that mom, I would be persisting in taking that phone out of the room at night, again, for her own good. Again, you know, as I said, the internet will give you what you want, it won't give you what you need. And as a parent, you need to give your child what they need rather than what they want.
Yeah, that was Dr. Coleman Nochter, Claire Daly, board member of CyberSafe Kids, and Aaron Wolfe, a representative of the ASTI Principals and Deputy Principals Committee, speaking with me late last year. If you want to listen back to this conversation or to any of the conversations in the Behind the Screens series, you can find them all right now on the Go Loud app. Just search for Tech Talk. This series was in partnership with CyberSafe Kids and was funded with money from the TV license. John Fardy is going to be here in just a quick minute with Screen Time. But that's it for me for the first show of 2026. I'm going to be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's News Talk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend. Hello, it's News Talk's Jess Kelly here. Before we get to this podcast, I want to talk to the business owners out there who know the value of having the right partner behind them. When it comes to empowering your business, Electric Ireland is the trusted energy brand that Irish companies rely on. As Ireland's leading energy supplier, they offer fixed price plans, expert advice and future-focused solutions, including solar power installation to support your business on its journey to net zero. Electric Ireland, making your business brighter. Visit electricireland.ie/business to learn more. Now, enjoy your podcast.